Hey everyone, welcome to Movie Crush, Mini Crush Monday. Monday morning.
Monday, Monday.
We love this day.
It's the best.
It is fun.
We're like anti-Garfield. We're the opposite of Garfield. We love Mondays.
Right. Although, to be fair, it is Thursday.
Oh. Whoa. Whoa. Chuck, he just blew my whole world open, man.
That has ruined everything.
I am too busy.
Yeah, it's Thursday morning here, and I just finished my triple latte. We just finished recording another one. We do these two at a time generally.
Yep.
Spoiler.
Mm.
And let's just get right to it, Noel.
I'm ready.
Because this is jam-packed. We got a great social studies segment.
Social studies on Movie Crush.
Now, this turned out to be a really fun question. I went to Facebook and asked, what is your favorite music cue? And I even said, you know, I'm not talking about the score, because not everyone knows what a music cue is. It's a specific song usage in a film. And about 98% of the people got that right. But some people still said, well, the score of Star Wars. It's like, well, it's not exactly a music cue.
No.
I mean, technically, I guess it is. But you know what I'm saying.
It's different. You're talking about a tune, like a song by an artist.
Correct.
That's used.
A song placement.
Yes, exactly.
All right. I'm going to go. Well, I'll say mine at the end, but I want to go through a lot of these because, man, people really got on board with this one. Megan Carroll, again, for the second week in a row, you are blowing my mind with how similar we are. She says, oh, my God. My dream job is music supervisor on a film. These days in the Royal Tannenbaums is just so fucking perfect.
That is wonderful. It's with Gwyneth Paltrow's character getting off the bus.
Yeah.
Smoking
Underground
cigarettes,
and Nico.
Walking slow-mo kind of while her
and
brother
the,
kind
the,
of
the Navy
her.
Midshipman cross in slow motion.
It's so good.
So good.
I mean, he's one of those directors that just nails the soundtrack.
Oh, I mean,
just to a T.
His music cues are all over this list.
Yeah. It's almost a joke. It's almost become a cliche how good his music cues are.
Yeah, for sure. My buddy Jeremy Kane in Washington State, he actually texted me or maybe on Facebooked me and was like, man, I didn't, because I take these down after I get enough answers just so, you know, people don't clog it up. And he said, man, I didn't get to answer. But he said, a quick one while he's away.
Mine. Love it.
In Rushmore by The Who.
Love it.
So classic.
Her man's been gone for so nigh good. On a year.
So good.
All right. We're going to go through a lot more of these. Ken Turpin, he got the most upvotes on the Facebook page for Damn It Feels Good to Be a Gangsta from Office Space, one of the classic music cues.
Very good.
Michael Hilton, and a bunch of people said this, and I will give it to him. For a more recent film, Immigrant Song and Thor Ragnarok, doesn't get much better. Really good usage.
It's also one of those songs that's so, like, potentially could be cliche and overused.
Yeah.
The way it's used in that one,
it crushes it.
So good.
Really good. Anna Marie Guido says, Down by the River to Pray by Alison Krauss and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? That whole movie is chock full of good music. Sean McFarlane, Head Over Heels by Tears for Fears. Will always remind me of the high school scene in Donnie Darko and then Jesse's Girl in Boogie Nights when Dirk and his friends are trying to rip off Albert Molina. It's pretty epic. Donnie Darko's all through here, too. That movie, you know that movie, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It managed to have some really great, great music cues.
I'm just starting to doubt your commitment to Sparkle Motion, Chuck.
Oh, that actress is so great. I can't remember her name, but character actor, she's wonderful. Chris Hurtado, one of the hardest-hitting songs. Again in Donnie Darko, when Mad World plays. Another great one.
It's actually, I'd heard that version of it, the kind of bummery piano version, before I heard the Tears for Fears version. I definitely prefer the Tears for Fears version, but that, just the song, it made me just fall in love with that song.
Yeah, that movie, I loved that. I mean, I still love it, but I really, really, really loved that movie when it came out.
Me too.
I saw it several times.
Yeah.
And what happened to Richard Kelly, man?
He made a couple weird ones. He made like a weird musical kind of with The Rock and
The Southland Tales was
one.
Just like it was like, I think it got the Razzie for worst movie.
Some people really dig it though.
Really?
I haven't seen it. I know it's got a cult following.
Maybe I'll check it out one day. I avoided it because I heard it was so bad. But how can you make something like Donnie Darko and then just fall off the rails like
that? Well, it's that thing where you have your whole life to make your first movie and plan it, and then
that's
you gotta
right.
keep pumping them out, and maybe it's, you know.
Same with records. Mike Pentola, Gimme Shelter, the opening of The Departed. Yeah. Martin Scorsese loves him some Rolling Stones. Greta Koenig says, in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Mike tells Mark one of his 5 dating tips, one of which is, when it comes to making out, play side one of Led Zeppelin 4. And Mark plays, is that a good Damone?
Oh, yeah.
Mark plays the song Kashmir in the car, and Greta very astutely points out, which we all know is from Physical Graffiti. That always stood out to me. How could they make that mistake?
Oh, that's funny.
Because it was Cameron Crowe.
Yeah.
Who wrote that.
That's hilarious. Why not just say Physical Graffiti?
I don't know. It had to be on purpose. I'm kind of curious about that. There's got to be a story there. Because that's a high-profile mistake to make. I'm going to go ahead and throw in She's Got to Be Somebody's Baby or Somebody's Baby from Jackson Browne, also from Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Brittany Story says, Sufjan Stevens, when Chicago by Sufjan Stevens plays in Little Miss Sunshine as the family drives in silence. Great movie.
Mm-hmm. In a van with my friends.
Well, yep. Pete, boy, I have no idea. There's a lot of consonants in your name, buddy. But I'm going to go with Holinage. I bet Pete's laughing right now.
You know, sometimes people really dig it when you just do a delightfully horrible pronunciation of their name. So,
well, there's got to be some silent letters here. It's Holonyj.
Holony. I don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I love it, Pete.
What would Pete say?
He said, "Goodfellas," that beautiful single tracking shot, of course, as Henry leads Karen through the bowels of the Copacabana, all set to "And Then He Kissed Me" by the Crystals. Absolute perfection. Agreed. Another Donnie Darko, Ryan Nims, and we've covered all of Donnie Darko at this point, Echo and the Bunnymen's Killing Moon at the beginning.
Huge fan.
Really good. Nick Holiday, oh yes, Sweet Emotion by Aerosmith, as that orange GTO rolls through the car park at the start of Dazed and Confused. Classic, classic beginning of a movie. Tammy Mitchell says, "I love this question. Pretty much every Wes Anderson movie," she said. "But if I had to choose, I would pick Needle in the Hay by Elliot Smith and Tannenbaum's."
That's a real heavy scene, too.
Very heavy scene.
Yeah.
Man. R.I.P. Elliot Smith. I loved him. Don Morris, "This Woman's Work" by Kate Bush, and She's Having a Baby. And I told Don on Facebook, I get teared up just reading that post because that song placement and what was going on in that movie is so sad. I can hardly even think about it without getting a little teary. Mary Beth Ward McDonough. You got a lot of great names there. 16 Candles, Sam walks out at the very end at the church, and If You Were Here starts as she sees Jake Ryan standing by his car. TJ Danny, the Save Me sing-along montage in Magnolia. It's probably one of the most beautiful movies and music moments I've ever witnessed.
Amy Mann.
Yeah, she killed it. I'm going to have her on one day.
She is so awesome. I've been a fan of hers for many years.
Yeah, I almost got her when she came through town in Atlanta, but she was doing because we have mutual friends who actually got in touch, and she was doing a radio interview and said she didn't like doing more than one thing in a day on a show day.
Yeah,
and I respect that. Man, I know Amy Mann would much rather have done this than a radio interview.
Oh, yeah, man. Those seem like a drag.
Just got to her first.
Yep, yep. Happens. Bummer.
All right, Teresa Barker. That's the Way from Led Zeppelin and Almost Famous with the band bus heading into the rising sun. I agree, Teresa. I would say that the Elton John Tiny Dancer moment is the one probably most often referenced from Almost Famous. But I'm with you that That's the Way music, I think, is greater than, subtly greater than. All right, a few more here. Richard Mouse, Vienna from the great Billy Joel, featured in 13 Going on 30. Richard and everyone else, I'm here to say 13 Going on 30 is one of my guilty pleasures. I love that movie.
Which one is that?
It's Jennifer Garner and the old switcheroo thing.
Oh, like the Freaky Friday kind of
thing. Yeah, she was a kid who wished she was older, and then she was older, but she still had the kid's brain.
And then she's like this gorgeous, statuesque woman acting like a goofball 12-year-old or 13-year-old.
Right? Yeah, yeah. It's just a wonderful movie. Mm-hmm. And I am I was about to say closet Billy Joel fan, but I'm not because I'm way out with that. Love Billy Joel, and Vienna's one of his greatest, greatest tunes. And the usage in that movie is really, really key. Edwin Forrest Glenn, a great one from Rushmore. Cat Stevens, The Wind, when they start flying the kite there at the end. Take Dictation.
I can't believe no one has mentioned Harold and Maude.
Someone did. And I didn't write it down.
Harold and Maude, you know, wall-to-wall Cat Stevens.
Yeah, man.
Turned me on to his music in a way that I'd never quite experienced before. And such a fantastic film. And the use of that music just really, like, takes it over the edge.
Yeah.
The Wind is in that film as well.
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always loved Cat Stevens. And in college, I was huge into Cat Stevens. And my buddy Eddie was huge into Bob Dylan. And we were both into both of them. But I was Cat Stevens. He was Bob Dylan. And we always joke that we were going to start an acoustic cover band called Bobcat.
That's funny.
I think we still might do it one day.
Sure.
Janet James Allman, Ms. Relou at the beginning of Pulp Fiction. Hard to argue with that one.
Funny, to call back to the last episode, we were talking about credits. Tarantino does that old school style of credits where he always has his credits up front.
Right. And that rolling yellow, is that, like Times New Roman or something?
I don't know, but it always gives him a chance to have like a hot track, you know, and really set the tone and like, you know, that's so good. Yeah. That was one of the first songs I learned to play on guitar where I realized like, oh, I'm not that bad at guitar. I can pick fast like that.
Oh, did you do that?
Yeah.
I saw Dick Dale
play
live. He uses, I can't remember what gauge guitar string, but it's basically like piano wire.
Oh, wow.
It's ridiculous because he just, you know, wails on that thing.
He played around here not terribly long ago, actually, at the Earl or a smaller venue.
Oh, yeah. That's the great thing about Dick Dale is you can see him with like 80 people in a room.
Yeah.
And then finally, we're going to finish up social studies with Kristen Egan, another one from Rushmore. Wes Anderson, you're doing it right. And special shout out to Mark Mothersbaugh, of course. Can't mention Wes Anderson without giving him credit. But she says, ooh la la from The Faces. Great, great song.
I have a quick question for you, Chuck. It's kind of combining this question with trope time.
Oh.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Give me your top three most cliche on the nose, hey guys, it's the 60s songs from movies.
Oh. Top three. That's tough. It'd be better to think of one. But
give me one.
I'll try.
Give me one.
It seems like I've seen a lot of Vietnam movies that used, or Vietnam, era movies that used, if you're going to San Francisco, that seems to be sort of kind of tops on the list.
Cool. That is not one that would have occurred to me, but I respect your choice. Mine are All Along the Watchtower.
Oh, 100%.
White Rabbit.
100%. Good.
And The Times They Are Changing.
I don't know that I've heard that one a ton.
Okay. Maybe it's just there's that Watchmen movie.
Oh, yeah.
That they use that song this montage of like the 60s. Uh-huh. And to me, I was just kind of like, okay, we get it.
Yeah.
It's the 60s. We don't need to hear this entire song. I don't know. I was watching Kong, the new King Kong Skull Island movie. And it had I watched it on a plane. And I watched it at the house the other day. Just like HBO was just on and it came on. And I kind of sat doing stuff around the house, and I heard the soundtrack, and it had like all of those songs.
That's pretty funny.
Hey guys, it's the 60s.
It's like work a little harder. All Along the Watchtower, for sure. That's been way overused.
Yeah. Yep.
And all its myriad versions. Mm-hmm. All right, Noel. Well, speaking of tropes, we are going to do another episode or a segment of Trope Time.
Yay. It's my favorite.
Where did we leave off last time?
We did the banker's box and the shopping bag.
That's it?
I think so. That's the last one. I think we've only done one of these.
Yeah, but we only did, I think we did a few more things than that. I'm looking at my list. Yeah, we did.
Sorry. The bulletproof vest reveal.
And the cliffhanger.
Yep. The grip.
Right, so I'll go through a few more of these.
Cool.
And we're going to run out soon. So we're going to start sourcing these from people too. I don't think we have done this one yet. The get a hold of yourself, you know, when somebody slaps somebody that's behaving hysterically.
Or gives them a real rough shake by the shoulders.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And that was famously aped in Airplane when the lady is losing it on the plane and there's just a line of people that one after the other slap her in the face.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Very good.
Yeah.
This one, I'm going to call it alcoholic relapse. Certainly do not want to make light of alcoholism, but as a movie trope, whenever there's an alcoholic relapse, they take that first sip of booze, and as I said on the website here, it may as well be dragon's blood,
yeah,
the way they take it to their mouth.
Yeah, and then next thing you know, cut to 2 days later and
right.
they're on the floor,
right.
you know, covered in urine or something, and there's just empty Jack Daniels bottles everywhere, you know.
It's funny. I'm going to – I had a friend one time who wrote a script that was like 200 and something pages long. And God bless him, he just wasn't a writer. And I was like, man, you gotta shorten this by like 100 pages. And he was like, what do you mean? And I was like, well, for instance, there's a scene in a bar where you walk through them doing shots and it's like 5 pages long. And he was like, yeah, but I had to show them getting drunk. And I was like, no, you don't. Mm-hmm. It's like, think about movies. You sit down, you show them order a shot, and then you cut to an hour later with 10 empty shot glasses yep. and they're soused.
Yeah.
It's like, that's how movies work.
Right.
You don't show them ordering food, deciding what's on the menu. And that's kind of what he did through the whole thing. And it was just a labor.
I mean, unless just like the dialogue is just solid gold and you get to walk through all that. Like, but even then there's going to be cuts.
No,
you know?
I mean, that, yeah.
No, no, no. I guess I'm thinking of like the opening scene of Reservoir Dogs where it feels like, that's a relatively real-time kind of moment, but it certainly doesn't show them, like, going through their whole meal.
No.
You know? No. No, it's true.
All right. Movie trope, Western movie trope, is the gun is empty, and what do? They throw it away.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I don't see this a whole lot anymore, but that used to be a big thing in Westerns. You're shooting, your six-shooter's empty, so you throw it away.
And maybe it's just out of frustration, just sheer it's a rage throw. There's also the trope of... You ran out of bullets and you think you're about to do the big kill.
Right.
And then click. And it click.
Uh-huh. Yeah. 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 And Jim Jarmusch, I don't think it was an interview. It might have been in, what is that movie? The one set in Brooklyn in the cigar shop that Jim Jarmusch acted in. Blue in the Face, I think.
I'm not sure about that one.
I think that's what it's called. But Jim Jarmusch is talking about that movie trope in a scene, and he says, he's like, guns are expensive.
Yeah.
He's like, you don't throw a gun away.
Seriously.
Very funny.
Especially on the range. It's like, what are the chances you're just gonna find yourself another gunsmith?
Right.
Just, you know?
Exactly. Hold on to that thing. Haunted House. Boy, we could do just Haunted House movie tropes forever. But here are a couple. Horror movie. I call it horror movie rule number 74. When you enter a haunted house or any generic bad place and you loudly announce that you're there, is anyone there? Hello? Randy, are you in here? If, like, Randy is the boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
You always got to do that. And then, finally, we'll finish with this one. Probably the most overused horror movie trope of all time, aside from the cat jumping down from whatever cabinet and scaring you, like jump scare, is the mirror gag.
Oh, sure.
Is you open so you're looking in a mirror.
Yeah.
You open the medicine cabinet.
Yeah.
You close the mirror and there's someone else there.
Right. And the thing about all this stuff, and we talked about this before, is now they're so overused and cliche that people play with them and kind of like, if you do a good job, you can kind of mess with people's expectations and kind of get, because you know what they're expecting and you can kind of toy with that and make it effective. But yet I still see people just doing the traditional mirror gag or the cat jump, you know? You're right, yeah.
It's great. True. It's part homage, partly because it works. But I have seen what you're talking about when they do the mirror gag and set you up and they close it and no one's there.
Yeah.
And then you go, oh. And then it happens
like
around the corner.
Exactly,
It's a very nice way to toy with the audience.
It's very cool.
And the mirror gag has been mocked on YouTube. I think there's a pretty funny supercut, if I remember correctly. All right, so that's trope time for this week. I'm going to start sourcing these pretty soon, so just start paying attention, people. We are going to move on now to stream this. This is when I recommend a movie that I believe is available for streaming. Well, kind of everything is almost these days. I'm going to go with the 2013 psychological thriller Enemy. Have you seen this?
Love it.
The great, great film from Denis Villeneuve.
It's Denis Villeneuve.
What is it?
It's Denis. Villeneuve, because he's French, you know? It's like Thomas Mars from Phoenix. It's Thomas.
Yeah.
It's definitely Denis. But yes, I only learned that recently because I heard
Dennis.
Him speak his name. Come on, Dennis.
I always feel like such a dumb American when I say things
it's,
like that.
It's easy.
All right. Denis Villeneuve, written by Javier Guillaume.
I don't know that one, but that sounds good.
And it is very loosely adapted from a novel from 2002 by Jose Saramago. And this is a movie, I don't want to give too much away, but it is a movie starring Jake Gyllenhaal, who I'm a big fan of, in a dual role as it's a doppelganger film. It's a man who basically sees himself one day, or a guy who looks just like him, obviously freaks him out. They are physically identical. And he ends up kind of tracking down this guy and facing him. And where it goes from there is very interesting and strange. And I don't want to give anything away. It stars Melanie Laurent, who I am a huge fan of and have a big crush on. From
what else was she in?
She kind of came on the map with Inglourious Basterds.
Ah, that's right. Was she the
the French girl?
Yeah, exactly. The real badass. Yeah.
Yeah, she's great. And Sarah Gadon and Isabella Rossellini are also in it, the great Isabella Rossellini. And like I said, I don't want to give too much away with the plot, but suffice to say, it goes in all sorts of weird directions. And this is a movie that really hangs with you after you see it. And it's one of those movies that you want to read about, because there are a lot of metaphors and symbolism involved once you start. I'll just say that spiders and spider webs play a big part.
It's very Lynchy.
Very Lynchy. Mm-hmm. And maybe one of the weirdest, most disturbing final shots of a movie of all time.
Oh, big time. Yeah. It leaves you feels.
Yeah. And also like, what the fuck was that last shot all about?
I know. No, it's awesome. It's a really... It's a very special movie. It's not for everyone, but I still think everyone should watch it.
Yeah, agreed. It was one of those where right, like literally 5 seconds after it ended, I opened up my laptop and I was like, enemy ending explained.
Same. Like, and it is. It all ties into the symbolism. And it's not one of those movies where you can take everything at face value. There's a lot of hidden Easter egg-y kind of things. Uh-huh. And it's a real cool movie.
Yep. Yeah. I'd love to hear from people about that ending. To see what you thought. And then we're going to finish up with Comment Card, where I take your Facebook questions for Nolan and I, and we're going to go with Abraham Schenk. He says, have you ever shushed a stranger in a movie theater? Shushed. And have you ever been shushed? I've never been shushed, for sure.
Yeah.
I'm not that guy.
No, I haven't been shushed, but... And I want to defend myself here. I went to a screening of the very challenging Russian film Stalker, which is great if you haven't seen it, with Casey, some work pals.
That's, what's his face?
Tarkovsky.
Yeah.
Tarkovsky. And I got in a little late, right as the movie was starting, and I kind of got separated from my friend. So it was like the very beginning, it was just the name of the production company, and I real quick tried to shoot my friend a text saying, hey, I'm sitting here, or I'll see you after the movie, or something like that. And this guy next to me was like, dude.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You got duded.
I got duded hard. And so from then on, I was super... self-conscious.
Well, and the shame you felt because you're a movie guy, and you don't want to be that guy either.
I really was trying to just be thoughtful, and like it was literally the opening Janus Films, you know, screen, and I was just like bloop, 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 and I was like, come on, man, give me a break. I felt like he overreacted.
Well, here's what I will say is certainly do not take out your phone in a movie, people.
No.
But if you do, shame on you, but if you do, for God's sakes, have that screen down at its lowest setting.
Damn it, man. Mine was definitely dim. This was a packed screening, too. It was like wall to wall, you know, so that was, I don't know. It was not one of my proudest moments, Chuck.
So here's my deal with shushing people. I've never really shushed anyone either because I am afraid of direct confrontation and I am passive aggressive. So I've definitely done the look a bunch of times and the kind of the half turn. But I've never directly shushed somebody. But I've wanted to, although I will usually these days, if the movie is not crowded and it's clear I'm near a problem person who's, you know, a repeat offender, I'll just get up and move.
Oh, yeah.
I'll take the path of least resistance.
I thought you were going to say you'd report them to the movie Gestapo.
No, I usually won't do that. It would have to be egregious to do that.
I've turned around and given a sharp look.
Uh-huh.
The shush is a bridge too far, man. I don't think I would ever shush.
Like literally go shh.
Come on.
Yeah.
You're also part of the problem at that point, right?
Yeah.
A loud shush, that's, you know, just as distracting as people talking.
Right. I would say the very adult way to handle it would be to lean over and say, "Hi, you're really kind of disturbing me. Would you I would appreciate it if you'd keep it quiet."
That's fair. Yeah.
But then they're like, "Dude, why are you giving me a lecture?"
Yeah. Come on, man. I guess the thing too is like movies are expensive.
Yeah.
And it's like if I ever go to a movie and there's someone that clearly is not respecting the fact that we've all paid money to be here and you know, why are you here? Go somewhere else. Do something else. You know, it bothers me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although I'll say the other thing that's bugged me lately, and for some reason this has happened in New York. It may be a New York thing. The past like three movies I've seen in New York, there's been a dude snoring, full on sleeping and snoring really, really loudly in the theater.
Okay. I've been guilty of that as well.
Really?
Not to that extreme. Let me again defend myself. I have a problem going to late movies, so I don't do it. But if I go to like a 9 o'clock movie, I'm gonna like nod from time to time, but I end up like waking myself up with a single snore because I'm really self-conscious about it. So I will never like full on. But when I go with my girlfriend and this happens, she always elbows me in the ribs, you know?
Right.
So I don't go to late movies. So.
Yeah, I hesitate to bag too much on the New York thing because it occurs to me now that is it possible that this is a homeless person who has scrapped up $8 to just go sleep in the warmth for a couple of hours?
I don't know.
Is that true?
I don't. It seems like there are alternatives to that. You know, maybe, I don't know. It's a good point. Maybe so. Yeah, especially if it's like winter. You probably could be pretty, pretty desperate to find somewhere like that.
Mm. All right. So our compassionate side is now coming out. But what do you do there? You go tap him on the shoulder?
Mm.
Say, sir, you're really snoring loud.
That's complicated.
It is.
We've really opened up Pandora's box here, Chuck.
All right. We spent a lot of time on that one. Megan Broyle says, what is your favorite John Candy movie? Oh, I miss John Candy. I'm going to go with probably two movies he's most known for, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and Uncle Buck. Great, great John Candy performances.
I like Uncle Buck a lot. Was he in Strange Brew?
No.
No, he's not. Who's in Strange Brew?
Well, the two guys are Dave Thomas and Rick Moranis.
But wasn't that kind of his scene, though? Weren't that like...
Yeah, well, you know, I haven't seen that in a long time. He may have had a small part
because
they were all part of the Second City
That's right.
Team.
Mm-hmm.
So he may have had a small part in that.
He was also fun in Home Alone. He's in the polka band that gives them a ride, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
Nick Erickson says, Chuckers, this is two questions, one for you, one for me. Chuckers, what got you interested in film in the first place? And Noel, and I'll let you think on this one, where'd you learn to write and mix such awesome songs, theme songs? So I'm going to answer first what got me interested in film in the first place. I'm going to say my brother, Scott. Had to be him. My parents were not super into movies. They never, certainly my father, I've joked before that the last movie, truthfully joked, that the last film my father has seen in the theater, I believe still to this day, is Bo Derek's Tarzan movie from the 80s.
Hubba Hubba.
Yeah, sure. My dad, he just, I mean, a little bit maybe. Like, I think I remember him seeing war movies occasionally. And I've said on the show before, he took me to see The Big Red One, the World War II movie. But they just, I don't know, they weren't into it. It's not like they hate movies, but my mom likes movies now, but it was never important for them to sit me down and be like, hey, you know, these are movies. This is film. This is great. This is important. You should see this. So my brother, for sure, got me into movies at a young age. Noel, talk about your music background.
I grew up playing violin. My parents were both opera singers, so it was really,
really?
Important to them. Yeah, so music has always been part of my life. And my mom, you know, toured. She was actually had a contract with the Metropolitan Opera in New York City for 20 years. And so I grew up kind of going to her performances, and she would go all over Europe. And I would go see her in New York when she was at the Met. And
I think I might have known that in the back of my brain. Yeah. I didn't know about your dad, though.
My dad, too, they met in the opera. He was less. His career was not quite as big as hers, but they both definitely were professional singers for many years. And so I got playing violin when I was six and kind of, you know, my dad was trying to groom me to be some sort of classical musician and it just wasn't for me. I got more into, you know, started discovering indie rock and different bands and kind of wanted to play guitar and write songs and played in many bands when I was younger. And
do you still play violin at all?
I have a violin. I could play it if I chose to. I actually, my experience with violin was pretty ultimately negative. It was something I was
but
sort
you,
of forced
you can make
to
the
do.
Sounds.
Oh,
though,
yeah, I can
which
play
is,
it. Yeah.
I have a violin. I took a couple of lessons. It is hard just to make that sound.
It's sort of like riding a bike, though. You don't really, I can definitely still do it. Right. And I actually, my bow is messed up. I want to get a new bow so I can use it for recording. But now I mainly just have a little home studio and have the, you know, great opportunity to be able to make music for work occasionally and also, you know, do stuff like what we're doing right now. So it's neat that I've been able to still keep fresh with those skills, even though I don't really play in bands anymore. I did up until a
recently,
handful of
right?
years ago. Yeah, yeah. But I've kind of just don't anymore. I just don't have time.
I hear you. So what all can you play?
I play guitar, drums, keys, bass. Violin, bass, most stringed instruments I can make a sound with. I could play a cello if I needed to. I played upright stand-up bass in the school orchestra for a while as well when I was younger. But I can't play like a wind instrument or a flute or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sort of like okay at a lot of things. I'm not incredibly proficient in any one thing, but I'm kind of cool with that because I can sort of, you know, make it go and use it to make records and just record myself. So that's what I do.
Noel's a very talented guy, everybody.
Oh, Chuck.
We're very lucky to have him. I actually can play a little bit of drums now, and here's my theory is that if you grew up playing air drums, then when you sit down at a drum kit, then you can, if you have a decent sense of rhythm and you feel like in your head you can divide things up between hands and feet, then you can maybe play drums a little bit.
Absolutely.
And that's what happened to me the first time I like sat down at a drum kit because I was used to playing air drums and not just aping air drums, but really kind of playing with my feet and my hands. I got sticks in my hand and I was like, wait a minute, I can play a little backbeat. Nothing flashy.
Super producer Casey Pegram, who used to do the Stuff You Should Know videos and is, you know, an amazing talented person in many ways, filmmaker. He is an incredible drummer.
Really?
And most of, he was in like the marching band and all that stuff. And most of what he does that continues him to kind of still keep those skills fresh is play rock band. And you know,
oh, yeah.
With the drum. And he has like the whole kit with like the pads and all that. Like the
so
kind
Casey's
of,
a good drummer.
Casey's a really good drummer.
Wow. Mm-hmm. We need a Stuff Media band.
That would be awesome. Yeah.
That'd be a lot of fun. All right, great question, Nick. Two more here. Anthony Noor says, movies with the best plot twist. Well, we've talked about Fight Club, of course. One of the great plot twists of all time, for sure, in Fight Club. And then I'm going to go with a movie called Primal Fear. What year was that? 96, actually, mid-90s. It was based on a novel directed by Gregory Hoblit, and it starred Richard Gere and... The first thing that I ever saw Edward Norton in.
I think it was definitely the first high-profile movie that he was in, for
did
sure.
Did you see it?
Oh, yeah. I love it. Yeah.
I'm not going to give anything away, but what a great, great plot twist in that movie.
Yeah.
I did not see it coming
at
all. I did not know that there was – it didn't feel like a plot twisty movie.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the best ones.
Those are the best ones.
Where
exactly.
You're like a lot of movies, you're like, all right, I know there's going to be some twist here probably.
Yeah.
But that one just sort of smacked me in the face out of the blue. So I'll go with Primal Fear. And then finally – Elena Barton says, do you have a favorite musical or do you even like them? Well, Elena, yes, I do like musicals. Not all musicals, but I love The Sound of Music. I love Chicago. I love Annie. Annie's great.
The film versions as well? You enjoy all those film versions?
Yeah, I mean, I'm mainly talking about the films.
I'm sorry. Sound of Music, I think, is exclusively a film. But Chicago, there was just the more recent one with Catherine Zeta-Jones. By recent, I guess I mean 10 years ago. But
It feels recent.
Yeah.
Great movie version. But I did see Chicago on Broadway in New York, and I did see Annie at the Fox Theater here in Atlanta, the touring Broadway show. So, yeah, I've seen those. Some stuff... well, Les Mis, jeez, it's fucking amazing.
That movie was so cool because they did all their own singing, like in the scene.
Yeah, the recent movie version
with
that,
like an earpiece in where they could hear the hear the track or whatever.
That made all the difference. And man, that Anne Hathaway's
Dream to Dream.
Yes, my lord, very powerful.
Yeah.
But I did I did not see Les Mis on Broadway yet, but that's on the list. Phantom, I did not enjoy so much, the Broadway show.
Yeah. It's just a, it's schmaltz. It's pure.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little on the nose, but I saw it when I was a kid, so I really liked it a lot.
I saw Rent recently.
Yeah.
At the Fox, which I think we may have even left to go get dinner. Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
We left during intermission, me and my friends, Eddie and Allison, who listened to the show, by the way. I think we were just hungry and sure. We weren't so into it.
Got it. Yeah, one that I've never understood was Cats. I saw it even you know in my youngest days of going to musicals with my mom in New York.
When you should have liked Cats.
I should have liked it. I just didn't get it. I just did not like it at all.
Yeah.
And maybe I like it more now. I just know didn't feel like it had much of a plot. It felt like it was all in service of like this kind of spectacle of just these, you know, people acting like cats and
right.
It's not for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I like musicals generally. So those are my faves. Good question, Elena. So that's it. This week, your homework, everybody, is the movie Arrival. I had Albert Hammond Jr., I was about to say in the studio, but this is on location. So the sound is going to be a little different than what you're used to. We recorded Albert Hammond Jr., by the way, is a musician. He is best known as a guitar player, one of the guitar players for the Strokes. But I am a huge fan of his solo work, more so than the Strokes even. And it was kind of one of those things where I was like, I want to meet Albert Hammond Jr.
Sure.
Wonder if he'd do it.
Yeah.
And he did. It was very nice. So I went to Terminal West, the venue where he was playing, got to see the second half of his sound check, which was kind of fun, and talked to him about The Arrival, which, to be fair, is not his all-time favorite movie. He didn't quite get the message through his PR people, but he picked a movie that he really loved, a recent movie that he really loved and wanted to talk about, which was kind of cool.
I'm a huge fan of that film.
Yeah, and it was fun to talk to him. We talked about music and life, and he's a very contemplative, interesting, kind of deep, sensitive guy. I enjoyed the conversation.
I look forward to that one. And by the way, Chuck, I want to compliment you on the Paul Schneider episode.
Oh, thanks,
I thought
man.
That was such a fantastic conversation.
It has gotten almost unanimous, like, best episode yet reviews.
It was just, I don't know, I was not around for that one, so I got to listen to it, like, as a fan, and it just made my day.
He
seems like the sweetest guy, and you guys just really had a great great rapport.
Yeah, it's funny, he texted me yesterday, because at the end of the thing, I was like, oh, I wish we lived in the same town, and he texted me yesterday and said, I wish we lived in the same town, too.
So that made me feel good. Bromance.
Yeah, bromance, big time. All right, so that's it. Watch The Arrival and look for Albert Hammond Jr. this Friday. And thanks a lot for listening, everybody. We'll see you next Monday.